Welcome to No Limits. I'm John Ketzenberger, sitting in as host for John Kroll. For today's show, we circle back around to a topic we brought you this past September, the Brain Project at Butler University. It's a program that has encompassed the campus figuratively and in some ways literally. Our guests today are Dr. Ina Shelley, Dean of Butler's College of Education, and Bob Postlewaite, a Butler trustee and former president of Eli Lilly and Company's Neuroscience Product Group. We'll discuss what the project is illuminating, what it could mean to brain health, and yes, even giant brain sculptures coming to campus. And of course, we always want to hear from you, our listeners. You can email us at nolimits@wfyi.org, call us at 866-476-3881, or hit us up at WFYI on Facebook and Twitter. We'll be back to talk about brains in a moment. Now this news. Welcome back to No Limits. I'm John Ketzenberger, in for John Kroll, and today we bookend the show we did on our Brain Project that got underway at Butler University last fall. Our guests are Dr. Ina Shelley, Dean of the Butler College of Education, and Butler trustee Bob Postlewaite, who once led Eli Lilly's Neuroscience Product Group. You can reach us at nolimits@wfyi.org, 866-476-3881, and at No Limits on the WFYI Facebook page, and on Twitter at WFYI. So, we've got Dr. Shelley and Bob Postlewaite. Thank you both for being here with us today.
Thank you.
Bob, let's start with you. I wanted to figure out what your interest is in the Brain Project. You're a trustee at Butler, and you were in neuroscience at Eli Lilly, so both seem very natural. But what is your interest in this project?
Well, thank you very much, John. And I'd like to thank WFYI. And, of course, No Limits is really quite a profound program in our community. And Kathy and I, my wife Kathy and I, really appreciate it. So, and I really welcome this opportunity to speak this afternoon. Kathy and I are a team, and a little bit of background. One Butler, the Brain Project, was conceived and fairly well articulated and designed when an outreach was made to us to participate in the program as facilitators and supporters. And I have to tell you, it was immediately a high priority for us. To participate and support them however we could. So how would I describe where we are at this point? I would say concerning brain health, mental illness, and in fact disorders that have been characterized as neurological disorders, in other words, associated with the aging process like dementia, Parkinson's, and these types of things, we are informed because of the role that you mentioned that I had at Eli Lilly and Company, and particularly the interface I had with patients during that period of time. But also, we have personal experiential informed empathy for what's going on here. And if I had to boil it down to just a couple of succinct statements about why we're engaged, there are significant opportunities to avoid the consequences of brain illnesses. And we're doing as a society a wonderful job in understanding the clinical course, understanding the pathological course of some of these disorders. We're falling somewhat short in application of things that we know work. So here's how we would position what Butler, the One Butler, the Brain Project is doing. Part of the continuum of care, which can be defined as promotion, prevention, treatment, and recovery, okay? And the focus right now, the sea change, and it's absolutely called for, is going from treatment and recovery to preempting the condition that needs to be treated and that would be prevention, but also promotion. And this is where One Butler, the Brain Project, absolutely gives me goosebumps, and I know I speak for my wife, Kathy, too. When you think about creating a cohort on the Butler campus, and this is with students, faculty, staff, the community, and I'll include the trustees here, that has a, let's say, a toolkit on how to take care of their brain, and beyond that, how to help others that may be vulnerable, in fact, may even be have risk factors that are aligned to the extent that they will eventually experience a need for mental health services, how to help them also cope with this. And this is another cohort, and Ina will definitely, I think this will resonate with her. We haven't talked about it before. But all of these Butler students that have seen this, well, not all of them, a portion of them will be young parents eventually. And we know that 50% of all lifetime mental illnesses begin under the age of 14, and 75% begin under the age of 24. So can you imagine equipping a cohort of future parents with this knowledge and the skills and the abilities to discern when they should intervene, to discern what a healthy environment is? It's just, like I said, I get goosebumps because it's an unprecedented opportunity.
Well, and you're talking about a campus, a community that is large and has a ripple. You know, whatever happens in at that campus will then ripple through the community. I want to talk some more about specifics in just a few minutes, but let's turn to Ina and talk about it from the Butler, you know, the campus perspective now. Mm-hmm. We understand why mm-hmm. Bob is so interested and eager to participate mm-hmm. in this, but you were on the development mm-hmm. side, and talk to me about why that is so exciting for Butler and what it is that you're trying to do.
Well, that's a wonderful question. I think the power of learning is when we all come together and when we define community beyond our own borders. And so sometimes universities can accidentally fall into silos. And the way we wanted to look at it is that all of the colleges, the students, the faculty, the alumni, and our greater community that surrounds the campus and in the city is a part of a learning community. And so how do we all come together to understand? And I think for me, one of the highlights that I have watched as we've had these incredible guest speakers on campus is that you have this intergenerational community of learners in the audience. And so you have young Butler students sitting next to older members of neighborhood. And that's what life is about. We're all interconnected. And so I think the power of this has been learning with each other, learning from one another, because that is how we will live with one another.
Well, that's been your experience in your own work at the College of Education as a dean and as a faculty member. You've reached out into the community and worked on building bridges and early childhood learning and that kind of thing. So you have a lot of experience in that. Mm-hmm. What are some of the specific things in the Brain Project that will be available, and how can people get access to those things?
Well, if you go to our website, of course, we always talk about websites,
and the address is?
Thank you for that setup. It's butler.edu/brainproject, space in those two words. You'll find the list of speakers. We are uploading the videos from the previous speakers. You'll see the upcoming events. We have, of course, you mentioned that the brain sculptures are arriving, and so tomorrow will be the big day of the unveiling and locating the 12 sculptures. There will be 11 on campus and one at the Butler Lab School. We are thrilled that on April 11th, Dr. Brian Handline, who's the chief medical officer for the NCAA, will spend the day on campus and do an evening session, but he will meet with students and student athletes because he's doing incredible work on what happens with concussions, and mm-hmm. so many people have suffered from concussions. On April 29th, we have the Applied Education Neuroscience Conference, which is applying what we know about the brain and learning and brain health for educators and parents. And we're very excited about that. I think as a teacher educator, this is so important of what we are able to teach our children about the brain and how to take control and responsibility for their brain. Well, you know, if you know how it works, then you know more about self-regulation. So we're at the Butler Lab School. We're doing some really interesting research that ties applied neuroscience to yoga, mindfulness, attention focus practices so that children can learn to control their behaviors. Why do I react this way? If I get angry quickly, what should I do about that? Why is that? So those are some of the events coming up. And I encourage people as we upload the videos from previous speakers too, because we have had an all-star set of speakers on campus. And I think it speaks to, John, to the community of Eskenazi and IU and community, how fortunate we are to live in a community to have such incredible resources, and they've all participated in this opportunity for us to learn from them.
I was really struck by the diversity of the people who are involved in your planning process. Yes. They come from all of those organizations. It's
Absolutely.
Not just a Butler project.
Right.
It's a real tapping into the resources of the community.
Yes.
And I'm looking forward to the artwork showing up too.
Yes.
The sculptures could be a lot of fun.
Absolutely.
There's also a symposium at the end of April, and I think that'll be something that's another chance for the community to interact with and be part of the process. Bob, Ina mentioned the brain injuries, concussions and things like that. Could you talk a little bit about the difference between brain injury, maintaining your brain through not doing things that hurt it, and disease and disorder? And some of the things that you were talking about earlier.
Yeah, I'll do my best on that question. I need to qualify. I'm not a neuroscientist, a neurologist, a practitioner, a psychiatrist. I'm a very interested and self-informed layperson in this space. But Tom McAllister, who is the department chair at IU School of Psychiatry at IU Med School, we were fortunate to have this world-class expert in what's called acquired brain injury. And so it's those things that happen by accident, whether you're playing football or volleyball. It's not a specific football issue, by the way, and Dr. McAllister made that very clear that there's no gender preference or sport preference in this acquired brain injury. But the trajectory of small, mild injuries to the brain is something that we all should concern ourselves about. There's a cumulative effect of mild brain injuries that can have implications, not even in late life, but midlife, consequences in your cognitive function and your ability for your brain to work the way it's designed to work. So we need to be careful. Now, you asked the question about some of the other disorders, and there's three main disorders that are considered serious mental illnesses. And, of course, that's major depression, schizophrenia, and bipolar disorder. But one could talk about post-traumatic stress disorder and there's several others that you could talk about, but those three are the main ones. And the risk factors associated with those have been well identified. In fact, the age of onset of those has been characterized pretty well, studied pretty well. And so those are different than what you ask about in the brain trauma,
right?
In that there's a genetic risk factor, there's environmental risk factor, and being aware of both of those factors can influence the possibility or the probability that you would eventually have one of those disorders or you would not have one of those disorders. And by the way, John, That has been the topic of presentations associated with lectures associated with One Butler, the Brain Project, specifically Alan Breyer of PARC, Prevention and Recovery Center at Eskenazi, made a very profound presentation on schizophrenia and spoke to a large audience, a sellout audience, about the risk factors associated with that, but also what he called early signs and symptoms that would lead one to want to know a little bit more about where they're headed.
Well, we'll get back to talking with Dr. Ina Shelley and Bob Postlewaite about the Brain Project at Butler University. Please rejoin us after the break, and until then, we'll see you soon. Welcome back to No Limits. I'm John Ketzenberger in for John Kroll, and today we bookend the show we did in the Brain Project that got underway at Butler University last fall. Our guests are Dr. Ina Shelley, Dean of the Butler College of Education, and Butler trustee Bob Postlewaite, who once led Lilly's Neuroscience Product Group. You can join us by email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can call us on the telephone at 866-476-3881. And at No Limits on the WFYI Facebook page and on Twitter at WFYI. Bob, I mentioned that you were part of the Neuroscience Product Group. That was in 1994 to 1995 when you retired. And that was the group that led Lilly's research and efforts into some really remarkable treatments for mental disorders and disease. But it's been a while since that occurred. In your observation, going from your professional years to your years involved in mental health on the more social programming side, what has changed the most in people understanding of the brain and mental health issues?
Wow, that's a really powerful question you ask. The major change in my mind is the notion that these disorders can be prevented or, in fact, addressed in such a way that they don't manifest and create life-altering circumstances. So the focus back in the day was very much around getting the diagnosis as well as you can, as clear and as accurate as you can, and then having a treatment protocol to try to help the patient. And the treatment protocol was not just pharmacy. It was psychotherapy and a lot of supports and a lot of other things were going on back in the day. But it was a day and a period of time, an era, where we did treat and try to support for recovery ongoing. Today, and this is a remarkable transition, a very important transition, what we know about the pathological course, these are in kind of insidious types of disorders. And what I mean by that is that the underlying condition, the pathology, oftentimes will advance pre-symptoms.
Right.
Pre-symptomatically. And so one might not even observe, or they're able to cope well with aberrant thoughts or inclinations to aberrant behaviors and this type of thing. And so early intervention is very, very important. That was known back in the day. But now we know that we've had researchers in this field understand that early intervention can change the clinical course over many years. And in fact, there are prevention mechanisms and even prodromal, which means pre-diagnosis symptomatology or behavioral changes that can be identified that can avoid, for example, in schizophrenia, first break. And this is remarkable stuff. So that's one major change. And then the other change is the notion of really broad education about the brain as an organ of the body that is subject and vulnerable to illness And you should take care. You can take care, like Ina was saying earlier, which I totally agree with. And it's just wonderful to hear her say these words about, you know, take care. You know,
right.
Get yourself informed and take care.
Right, just like you would in any other aspect of your health, take care of your mental health. So, Ina, obviously that awareness is one of the things that led you to want to do the Brain Project. Could you have done this 5 or 10 years ago? Would it have been the same kind of program in the acceptance or in the participation phase? Do you think people were ready for it that time?
Wow, that's a great question. I don't think we were quite ready. I don't know that we were as aware. I think we were, as Bob was saying, we were more in the treatment and recovery, thinking about that and not being as proactive. But I think I know that, you know, spending a lot of time in schools, I've seen more and more challenges and issues and wondering. And my colleagues on campus, I have amazing colleagues on campus that are curious about this. So I think the timing was just right, that now we're at a place where I think in most aspects of our lives, we're trying to be more proactive and more understanding. But I think the research is much more solid. And I think seeing different disciplines coming together, there's more transdisciplinary kind of work coming together. So I think the timing was just right.
If you want to join us here at No Limits, you can email us at nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can also catch No Limits on the WFYI Facebook page or on Twitter at WFYI. So contact with us and join the discussion if you'd like. Ina, you were talking about how research has caught up and is advancing. How much do you hope to accomplish in that regard? How will this help with that effort, the research and awareness?
Well, I think the more we know, the more questions we have. I think the sophistication of in the medical field, in the neuroscience field, but also then in the education field of trying to take what is learned from those fields and apply it becomes more and more evident and more transparent over time. I was thinking about, if you think about college students, for example, especially today with technology, they often think they're masters of multitasking, which is really task switching that I learned from my colleagues, Dr. Line Weaver and Mandy Ginrich, for example. So our students are learning, oh, maybe I can't do multitasking. And then they learned about the importance of food and brain health. Oh, didn't realize what blueberries can do for your brain, right? And then I think about, you know, students love music. Well, we have Dr. Tim Bremer, who does this amazing work in a neuromusic lab. So they're learning about that. We didn't know a lot of this previously. So I think, you know, it's all kind of coming together. And then we have Stephanie Jackson is coming on April 3rd. Dr. Jackson will talk to us about sleep and brain health. So as more and more research is done and then we see how it can be applied, I think the better we're going to be and the more we're going to be on this prevention side. So I think it's one of the most exciting fields to be paying attention to right now.
Well, and there's certainly a lot of effort being made in that area. And Bob, I know you're a chemical engineer. You're not a doctor or any related mental psychiatric field. But the brain is a remarkable organ that has long been either not understood, misunderstood, or not, we really just... One of the things that I think is interesting is people say, well, you only use 10% of the capacity of your brain. How do we know that? Because we don't know enough about the brain. So talk a little bit about, where we are, you think, in terms of the arc of understanding the brain and where we might be going with this.
So one of the advantages of being early retired and having this interest is I find a lot of purpose, and my wife also we find a lot of purpose in what we're doing and what we're up to. Jill Bolte Taylor, who is the architect of the brains that will be on show starting soon, starting tomorrow, I guess. We've all learned a lot from her. She is a I call her a national treasure. Okay, And so we talk about brain development and how fantastic this 3 pounds is and how important it is to our lives. They say, you know, no thought, no life, and no mental health, no health. What Dr. Bolte Taylor has brought to our attention most recently on the Butler campus, but more generally for many years, is how to be aware of how the brain grows, what helps it develop in a really good way, a sustainable way, a neuroprotective way, and how your behaviors can interact with it. And then also how those times and those periods of high susceptibility, how to know yourself. And so your question is also an interesting question from another perspective. I wanted to highlight Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor in that respect. But the other thing is, back in the late 80s, early 90s, I became very interested in the brain as part of my professional experience at Lilly because of the exposure that I got because of my role with people that were suffering from these illnesses. And they're basically, at that point in time, for sure, fault-free. In other words, there was a lot of stigma, a lot of fear, a lot of concern about folks that were having mental illnesses. There were other terms used instead of mental right. illness back in the day, or brain illness back in the day. There were other terms that were used that were also stigmatizing by their very nature. But I really couldn't come to grips that the center of control of our thoughts and our behaviors and our impulses would be isolated from the vulnerability of diseases of other parts of the body, like you well said, John, earlier on in this discussion. And so I started self-informing, and then as things evolved, coming back from London, Lilly organized to increase a focus on therapeutic areas, and I'd already been working in the neuroscience area, but I was extremely gratified and learned an awful lot by being involved with people at Lilly that absolutely world-class. I mean, they were breaking new ground and new boundaries in what's understood about the brain and how it impacts mood and behaviors, but also how it ages at that point in time. And it was like wonderful for me to be able to engage with a group of world-class leaders in the science and the research, and also focused on the practicality. In other words, research was done with a purpose, and that's to help patients.
Right.
Okay. And there was a cohort at Lilly during that period of time. There still is, obviously. But at that period of time that I joined, that was very focused on the patient and that exposure to the patient. And then later on, when I became experientially involved, I mean, like many families, we've had an occasion for accessing mental health services. And so all these experiences came together to make me very, very interested in this 3 pound.
Yeah, that organ the organ that is all organs, right?
Yes.
And I think it's interesting to note that, you know, Lilly remains on the edge of those kinds of research efforts. They're not alone. I mean, one of the reasons we're even having this conversation is because of the advancements being made in both treatment and understanding of the brain. But you know, it's a difficult field. I mean, they make advances in some areas, and then some areas where they think they have great promise, the treatment won't work.
Yeah, yeah, and you may be referring now to the recent work in Alzheimer's,
right?
Dementia, and of course, Alzheimer's is indeed an intractable disorder, disease of the brain. But you know something, I am optimistic, and the drivers are very clear. It's not only the onerous effect of economically, socially, emotionally, on the family, et cetera, mm-hmm. that Alzheimer's presents, but it's also the lack of the upside. Imagine, if you would, for a second, this is a thought experiment. If we could get 5 more years of clear, thoughtful wisdom applied to this world's problems, and that those years would be from 65 to 70 or from 70 to 75, imagine how different this world might be. It's a thought experiment. But I imagine that, and imagine that a company like Lilly that's investing billions of dollars, they may be saving the cognitive function of people that are going to solve this, you know, world conflict. They're going to solve the sustainability of our planet's a bit at risk with the warming and this type of thing. But these people, with that extra time of really lucid and clear ideas and the wisdom that goes along with age, I like to think as I approach 70 that I'm getting pretty wise here. But
better not older.
Well, our kids keep me in place, keep me humble. But so it's really wonderful. So in as much as it's intractable, okay, mm-hmm. the progress being made right now on understanding the disease pathology, the fact that early intervention, when the memory, the limbic and the hippocampus are still intact and still there, and then intervening at that point in time to preclude the pathology advancing, I think there's great promise there. I'm optimistic.
Yeah, and reasonably so, because of the advancements that have been made in a relatively short period of time. When you were saying back in the day earlier, you were talking about less than 30 years ago. I mean, that's the rapid track of advancement we've had so far. This is a little bit different, but listener Steve would like to know if autism falls within the realm of mental health disorders and functions.
Yes. Yeah. Now, Steve would need to seek people that are more better qualified to answer that specific question. But there's a spectrum of disorders, and anything that impairs normal functioning and ability to interact and these types of things would be considered. If it's mediated through the central nervous system, through the brain, then it would be considered a brain illness.
And it seems to me that the advocacy in terms of autism and the understanding of autism in the last several years is really reflective of the larger understanding in society. Is that right, Ina?
I think that's very true. And I think one of the opportunities, I like to say that challenges are opportunities in disguise. And I think autism is an area that has been a challenge, but a great opportunity for us as educators to learn more and more about what is that spectrum and what do we need to do as educators? What do we need to know and be able to do, not only to support the child, but to support the family? Because it is always about, you know, one unit of the child and the family. So I think it's become more complicated. When I look at what educators face today as compared to when I began, the diversity of needs and the increased knowledge that we must have, especially in areas like autism, have greatly challenged us, but great opportunities for learning.
Well, and that's the way to look at it, because people want to say, well, in the old days, and in the old days, we didn't understand why people
that's
behaved
right.
this way or children behaved this way.
Right.
So with greater understanding needs to come greater empathy and better results, better treatment for these kinds of things.
Exactly. And if I can put in a small plug for PBS, hooray for them. They've introduced Juliet into Sesame Street. Hooray, they have a child who's autistic in their cast, and I think that's fabulous.
Yeah, it's really a matter of better understanding and reflecting mm-hmm. what we see in the society.
Yes.
Well, I think that the question about autism also reflects, and this is not a criticism of Steve, but I think it reflects still that there's a lack of more understanding about what's going on in mental health issues. And we'll get into talking about that pretty soon, because we're about ready to go into a break. And so when we come back from that break, we'll tackle that issue that we've been talking about so far, and that is the understanding of mental illness, of how we can maintain our brains, and how we can as a society, have a better understanding of all of these issues. So please join me and our guests, Bob Postlewaite and Ina Shelley, when we come back from the break. And welcome back to No Limits. I'm John Ketzenberger, in for John Krull. And today we bookend the show we did on the Brain Project that got underway at Butler University last fall. Our guests are Dr. Ina Shelley, Dean of the Butler College of Education, and Butler trustee Bob Postlewaite, who once led Lilly's Neuroscience Product Group. You can reach us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Give us a call at 866-476-3881. Or you can reach us on the WFYI Facebook page at No Limits or on Twitter at WFYI. So before the break, we were talking a little bit about the understanding of mental health and protecting the brain. And so I just wondered if there were any final thoughts about where we are in the state of that understanding and where do you think it's going to go over the next few years?
I think through a project like One Butler, the Brain Project, and efforts in the entire community, the more we understand, the more accepting we are, the more preventative we are. And I think we have to continue this kind of dialogue and this kind of education. Bob had mentioned earlier, removing the stigmas that are often associated with mental health. And I think once we can have more of these kinds of conversations where we really go into deep understanding, the better we are, the more inclusive we are as a community. And I think that's extremely important. We talk about being inclusive in schools. Well, we need to be inclusive in our community. And we do that when we know more, we do better.
And it seems to me that, you know, there was a long time with those stigmas and with the way, you know, our medical system works, it was more difficult to gain access to mental health treatments and methods because of insurance problems. But it seems like that's getting better, too. We'll see what happens with, you know, the Affordable Care Act and all of that. But it seems like access to treatments and prevention programs for mental health issues is greater than it was, too. Is that an accurate assessment?
It's improving.
Okay.
Okay. I don't think we haven't arrived by any stretch of the imagination. There's still probably, this is not my data, but other folks' data, 50% of the population that could benefit from mental health services either does not practice help-seeking behavior. In other words, does not seek out help for whatever reason. It could be stigma. Could be other barriers to access, like cost, mm-hmm. financial reasons.
Right.
But I do think we need to continue to focus on workforce and workforce practices so that evidence-based programs and practices become common practice. And eventually, if we can migrate from a fee-for-service type of a compensation program to an outcome population health that includes mental health metrics, I think that would be very positive. The integration, this is one thing, John, and you kind of hit on this, and I think is really important, and it is happening, and it's really positive, is the integration of mental health with primary care services. And everything from kind of making automatic assessments, you can imagine how that deals with obviates the case of stigma. Because if you're there for a headache, you're there for the flu, you're there for anything, and you get a very effective but easy mood assessment tool that's in use all the time there, you have a way of seeing patients in a not unstigmatized way. And if there is something that triggers, if there's a signal there for a type of a mood disorder, you can take care of it right there. And that's a big deal. So these types of things are happening. And, you know, there's leaders in our community, you know, Suzanne Clifford out at Community and Lisa Harris at Eskenazi, and there's others I could mention, but they have this whole notion of wellness and prevention and recognizing the role of depression on outcomes that are called somatic or physical disease outcomes. It's unequivocal. We know for a fact that your mood influences your outcome in a physical disorder, whether it's diabetes or a heart condition or whatever. And these leaders are enlightened leaders, and it all bodes really well. Like I said, I continue to be an optimist, although we've been at it for a long time. And the needle, sometimes you feel good, and then all of a sudden there's a big setback. So we're not there, John. But your question and this type of show, too, is mm-hmm. really important to get the word out.
So one of the best things in the community is springtime on the Butler campus and the beautiful area that you have. And it is a beautiful area. But this year you have the Brains, the artwork mm-hmm. that Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor commissioned mm-hmm. as part of this project. And we should talk, just mention that Dr. Bolte Taylor had been a researcher in Brains and suffered a stroke and then regained health. And so she has a really unique and interesting perspective on the brain and all of that's associated with that. So she commissioned these sculptures. Ina, tell me about the sculptures, what you hope to, and what people will see when they see these sculptures, and what you hope to accomplish with them.
Absolutely. Well, I think Bob said it best that Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor is a national treasure. If you've not read her book, The Stroke of Insight, it's a must read. And through her experience of having this stroke and recovery, the artistic aspects of her brain really became her language and understanding and helping her find her way back. And she has commissioned these amazing brain sculptures, and they're large. They're like 5 feet by 5 feet by 4 feet.
Wow.
And they represent different aspects of the brain, so the aging brain, the schizophrenic brain. So you're going to see all different types of brain sculptures. And 11 of them will be on campus. They'll be in different buildings in different locations. So if you go back to the website at butler.edu/thebrainproject, you'll find the map. And we encourage people. We envision lots of members, again, all ages, coming to campus and interacting and learning about these different parts of the brain. We're hoping for busloads of children to come as spring field trips happen. And, of course, the Butler students, we're very excited that the Butler students have different student groups have adopted different brains. So they're taking responsibility. Like, I am over the Alzheimer's brain. Okay, good for you. And so they will be making sure that exhibit is well taken care of, but also interacting with people as they come on campus. So we think it's a great opportunity. And I want to say that Jill was our commencement speaker a year ago. It was a terrific commencement speech. And now to think that we have her beautiful artwork and we're continuing to learn from her a year later is quite a gift. She will be there tomorrow as we install the brain sculptures, the installation, and she will be speaking briefly at noon in front of Clues Hall. So anyone and everyone is welcome.
Yeah, go out there, and hopefully you'll get great weather for it, and yes. It is a beautiful place. But I want to be clear about this. Is Jill the artist for this?
Yes.
So she's the one who yes. was commissioned to yes. create these art pieces.
She commissioned them. She worked with other artists.
Other artists,
yes,
okay.
But it was her big vision.
Her idea,
her big vision of how to create these. So she created these with other artists.
Okay,
yes.
And Jill is a Hoosier.
Yes, she is.
So
yes, she is. Terre Haute, Indiana was her home.
Mm-hmm. That's an exciting aspect of all of this. Mm-hmm. Bob, what do you think about it?
Yeah, so John, earlier we were talking a little bit about where the One Butler, the Brain Project could take us. And this is another kind of thought experiment that...
I like your thought experiments.
Well, you know, they've served me well, I think, over the last 40 years, both with my family and with my my professional interests and also my advocacy on behalf of people that have brains.
Right.
You know.
Which would be...
If you have brain, you're at risk, and most of us do. So, is to kind of dream up some circumstance that we would like to see. Suspending all limitations, okay? And So I've done this one. I'm going to do it really quickly here. This will only take a minute, I think, maybe a little bit longer. But so Chris Holtman is the coach of the Butler basketball team, and you know Butler has a basketball team, right?
Pretty darn good one.
Yeah, so for three seasons he's been the head coach, and I've just observed him and watched him over these three seasons. And so I'm using him kind of as a way of teeing up this topic. And so my first – I have some comments here. So, one, what if we all were as diligent in taking care of our brain as Coach Holtman is in taking care of his players?
Right.
Okay. Number two, what if we pursued knowledge about our brain, how it gets ill, how to protect it, how to nurture it, as Coach Holtman does – in his deliberate skills practice enforced on his team members. Number three, what if we were as diligent in looking after the brain health of our loved ones, family, friends, and the greater good as Coach Holtman is about his team play and player affinity, caring for one each other, and further the welfare of the Big East and the NCAA? Four, what if we were as objective in our self-assessment of our brain-healthy behaviors as Coach Holtman is in his candid and open reflection and personal accountability on his own performance as coach? Five, what if we owned our brain health like Coach Holtman owns the team outcomes? And I'm not just talking win-loss record here, but method and the Butler way. Six, what if we were as fanatical in keeping our brain healthy and ready to perform as Coach Holtman is in his holistic approach to player mental preparation for peak performance and use of skills on the court? And last, what if we were all the time thinking strategically about our brain health as Coach Holtman is about the future of Butler, Butler basketball, and most importantly, the future and well-being of his players that he only has for a little while?
Yeah, and that would bode well for overall mental health and brain health. And I think that's really what we're talking about at this point.
Yeah, and I do think that this tremendous gift from Butler to the students, to the community, to the staff, and to the faculty, that's the One Butler, the Brain Project, is an enabler. And what it does, it'll change the trajectory of their brain health and people that come into contact with them. It's a tremendous gift that Butler's given.
Let's go to the phone. We have Bruce on the phone, and he wants to talk about bipolar disorders.
Okay, I wanted to make a couple of comments. One is that, if this already hasn't been mentioned, at Butler and everywhere, 18-year-olds are legal adults, and many will refuse to take medications or have other treatments. Side effects can be very difficult to bear. And secondly, bipolar disorder particularly is very difficult to diagnose properly. There are so many factors to it that can be misread as everything from depression to anxiety. And therefore, to have primary care physicians qualified, capable of diagnosing this, that'd be a really good trick.
Okay, Bruce, thank you very much for your call. We also have a – well, let me – before we get on to another thing, do you have any reaction to what Bruce had to say?
No, I agree with him. My earlier statement had to do with a mood assessment at the primary care setting and the integration there. I think Bruce's comment and thoughts about bipolar disorder are accurate.
Yeah, and an indication that we still have much to learn about getting to the place where we want to be when it comes to brain health.
Yeah.
Here's a question from Scott or Clyde from Twitter, rather. And I'm going to ask you this, Ina, and it has to do with the pressure and stress from standardized testing in school.
I love to talk about that. How many hours do you have?
Well, we only have a couple of minutes, actually. So, unfortunately, we have that question
exactly.
At this point, but
sure.
Talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think it's very interesting. It is something that in our country I think we've become – we're over testing our children. And when we think about, for example, we lose up to 8 weeks of instructional time in an academic year preparing for tests and administering tests. And I think the children, as hard as teachers and administrators try to not make them feel stressful. They're smart, and they know that there's high stakes in this, and that something there's some outcome to this. What I can tell you that I've seen in many schools and firsthand in the Butler Lab School is we actually teach the children breathing techniques, and that this is just one moment in time. And we use what we call yoga spray, which is lavender-scented water. And the children will say, "I need some yoga water right now." and is as hard as we try to not make it stressful, it is there. And when you look at other countries, they are not doing this. They are not spending the amount of time and money on this kind of testing. And so I really would like for people other than teachers to speak up about this. I can tell you that our chief financial officer at Butler, I'm so proud of Bruce Eric, he volunteers once a week in an IPS school. And he said, he asked me just last week, he said, "I don't understand all this time being spent on testing." And I said, "It's when people like you start questioning and speaking up, we can change this. What could we do better in types of assessments, and how could we use our time more wisely and help our children?" That's not to say that children should never feel stressed. They will experience that. But I do think that we've come, I think the pendulum has come way too far to the right on the amount of testing and stress.
Well, and there are relative levels of stress, right?
Yes.
There's a stress that can be healthy in the sense that it builds up, your ability to deal with situations and that kind of thing.
Yes.
But what you're talking about is the unhealthier stress that's brought on by, situation like the high-stakes testing that has occurred. You believe that there's a way to conduct assessments in public schools that doesn't induce that harmful stress?
I do. I think one of the things we've moved away from is high quality qualitative assessment, and really effective teachers know how to do this. In fact, I would tell you the majority of teachers can tell you how children are going to score on a standardized test before they even take it, because they've observed them. They do ongoing assessments, watching children's work, collecting work, taking examples over time, and I think we need to move back to trusting teachers more on that kind of assessment, and then have periodic, shorter assessments along the way.
So it's possible to get this done from your professional perspective, and also from your understanding in the BRAIN Project.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So it's a year-long effort, the BRAIN Project, and we've talked a lot about its accessibility and about the brain and the health and all of those issues. But personally, real quickly from each of you, what is the thing you're looking forward to most about the BRAIN Project?
I would say that this is never going to end. And I think the connections made internally and externally through this project, this is just the beginning. And I think these ongoing relationships of learning from one another will continue. So it's just the beginning, not the end.
And Bob, quickly?
The same. I mean, I'm totally aligned with what Ina said. This is an investment and a legacy that's going to be very, very important, I believe.
Well, that'll have to do it for today's conversation. I'd like to thank my guest, Dr. Ina Shelley of Butler University's College of Education, and Butler trustee Bob Postlewaite. And be sure to tune in Thursday for John Krull's new interview with Hoosier bestselling authors James Alexander Tom and his wife, Dark Rain. I'm John Ketzenberger. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.